Welcome, welcome, welcome. How's everybody doing? Hope you are doing well. My name is Andrew Kuhn with Focus Compounding, on air live with Jeff Gannon. Jeff, how's it going today?
It's going very well, Andrew. How's it going with you?
It's going great. We hope it's going great with everybody else as well. If this is the first time you're tuning in with us, thank you so much for joining us. Be sure to check out all of our content that we push out into the investing universe. Of course, the best way to do that is to follow me on X at Focus Compound. If you're interested in getting access to investment write-ups from Jeff going all the way back to 2005, of course, go to focuscompound.com and you can get access to all of that for free. All the information is in the description below. So in today's podcast, Jeff, we are going to talk about Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway annual letter that went out this past weekend. He had opened up the letter with a tribute to Charlie Munger. What'd you think of this font right here? Charlie Munger, the architect of Berkshire Hathaway. Is that like a nostalgia thing because they used to do that? I mean, what is that, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, thinking back to Ben Franklin and stuff, I think, probably.
Yeah, loved it. He wrote one page. It was beautifully written, giving a tribute to his business partner and pal, Charlie Munger. I thought it was beautiful. I did wonder. I was like, I wonder if he ever got the opportunity to tell him this in person. I was thinking, you know, maybe what are the odds that he pre-wrote it and told Charlie, this is, I just want to, you know, let you know what it's going to say eventually when this day comes and how much you mean to me. I thought it was just wonderful. If you are familiar with their partnership and the story, you'd be definitely familiar with a lot of stuff that Buffett wrote about. Basically, Munger telling Buffett to get away from how you made all this money, the way that you learned to invest from Benjamin Graham, and start buying wonderful businesses at fair prices as opposed to, you know, crappy businesses at wonderful prices. And, you know, it was beautiful. One thing that I thought was interesting was when Buffett said that Munger made the decision to go into money management. I thought that was interesting because Munger always talked about, you know, Buffett kind of pushed him to go into money management. So what were your thoughts on this? I thought it was beautifully written, a great tribute to his partner.
Yeah, very good. And I'm sure people were expecting that there'd be something about it, and putting it as a separate thing before the rest of the letter makes a lot of sense. So I think it worked really well that way.
Yeah, in 1962, he decided that he should take up money management. I don't know why. I just thought that was great, just because Munger always talked about how, like, Buffett kind of said, look, practicing law is great as a hobby, but you should really get into money management. Of course, Munger decided to make that jump. But to me, it was Buffett's way of saying, I'm not making this about me. This is about Charlie and how he got into the business and how we ultimately became partners, you know? And him describing Munger as the architect of Berkshire. What were your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, he doesn't give Charlie credit for things that he didn't do, so he doesn't make it sound like Charlie was actually there putting as much into Berkshire over the years as he was. He says that Charlie had the big idea and stuff, you know, which makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
It's probably the way that Charlie would want to be acknowledged. You know, so I thought that was great. What did you think about the actual annual letter itself? We could get into that.
I thought it was a very good one.
I did too.
I thought it was somewhat, I don't know about pessimistic, but it was certainly focused on negative things as compared to many letters. Some of the reasons were because Berkshire's performance in some things was not so good, so he wanted to single that out. But it was also just in general downbeat on the ability to apply a lot of capital to the areas of things that they own completely, and also their size. And so that makes it sound like there's not a lot of possibilities that way. There's some different things too. It does sound more like he talks a little bit more about, I think it sounds more like there might not be a transformative type of deal, while he's still at Berkshire. And he does talk about the three most important people at Berkshire and stuff instead of just talking about himself that way or something separately, like he would with him and Charlie Moore. So it does sound a little bit more like he's resigned to the idea that there can't be a lot of big changes that will move the needle, kind of, is, I guess, my feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, is this the first time that he ever just came out and said, all in all, we have no possibility of eye-popping performance?
Yeah, which is a very realistic letter that way. And actually very realistic in saying things like that there's basically no possibility to make meaningful purchases of the size they need outside the United States, that it's only inside the United States they could do it. He lays out some of the math about that. So these are not things that are news to people who follow Berkshire and kind of try to figure this out, but he's very open about that now.
What did you think about, so he was talking about the types of companies that they look to invest in. He gives his spiel about favored businesses being run by able and trustworthy managers. And then he talks about a quote that was given where it says, never deal with a rascal under the expectation that you can prevent him from cheating you. People are not that easy to read. Sincerity and empathy can easily be faked. That is as true now as it was in 1863. What is that?
Yes.
What's he?
So this is about Pilot
to?
Flying J. Yeah.
Yeah.
And this goes throughout. I think it's mostly about Pilot Flying J, but I also think that it's connected with that into some other things that he talks about with maybe the type of market that we're in and stuff like that. So throughout, he keeps making mentions of reading people and dealing with rascals, like you said, even earlier where he talks about directing this to his sister as if he's writing the letter and she's the intended audience. He says that, what she does understand is incentives, the weaknesses of humans, the tells that can be recognized when observing human behavior. She knows who is selling and who can be trusted. In short, she's nobody's fool. So that part is also related to things that we talked about there. So people who know that story, Berkshire made a big purchase of a company, which, like some of the other ones, has sort of a payout. It, basically what price they'll buy the rest of the company at in stages based on the earnings later on. The sellers accused Berkshire of changing the accounting to result in lower earnings and stuff. And then there's accusations on the other side. This case was settled by the two parties, but there's still apparently investigations by the FBI and stuff of that.
By the FBI?
Of the selling, I believe so, of the possibility that there were payments made.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's
I guess
my understanding.
I'm not so caught up to date on this, so maybe for people that are in the
same
boat,
no settlement with there was no settlement with the government as part of this deal. So if he said that he was going to make payments to them, that would potentially be criminal issues. So that he was basically going to make payments to the selling shareholder. It was accused of, promising to make payments to people if they basically accelerated what the earnings would be and stuff. That would cause a problem. Berkshire's a public company. If that this is part of the company that they bought already, so then that would cause all sorts of things where it's facilitating a fraud and stuff like that. So, I don't know if there's been any news on that part of it, but I would assume that that's the case.
Wow. I did see a press release about a month ago that they were buying the rest of the stake or whatever, like the final 20% of the company.
Yeah. So all I can see is that there's still no change on the fact that it says that, as far as the last news reports were, is that press reports are that there's a federal investigation of bribery. So it actually says prosecutors and stuff, but I don't know what that would be otherwise. So. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, so it's crazy.
But they settled the two of them on the price and stuff. So I don't know if what that means and what that will change and everything. But they were going to go to court over it and stuff, and they settled. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. What did you think about Berkshire Hathaway Energy?
He's very negative on Berkshire Hathaway Energy, and this may be a major pivot by the company. because if they decide that they can no longer put lots of capital into the business, and the Berkshire Hathaway Energy historically doesn't pay dividends, it's one of the only utilities in the country that it's like the only utility in the country that would be retaining large amounts of money year to year to invest it. And I think that maybe they're going to decide that they shouldn't do that anymore. And that could also help move Berkshire more to having to pay out dividends and stuff, which there's some hint of that in the letter, I would say. He said historically has not paid dividends when discussing their quality as an insurance company. He didn't say that they have no intention of paying dividends or anything. I don't know how much they could. I mean, they would pile up cash even faster, it sounds like. And so I think it'll take a long time, but I think they probably won't reinvest at the rates that they were before. And he's down on the power business long term, probably that way. So because of government things and stuff, basically, this is a liability related to fires, those sorts of things, but also just the returns that regulated utilities can earn. It was a risk. He's bet big on a couple of things that do depend a lot on the government. And so that's always part of it. At the time, it looked better, the utilities and the railroad. And now maybe he regrets that, certainly with the utilities and probably the railroad, that the threat of, you know, the government not allowing you to earn as good a return as you thought before is probably higher. So, but that's just a change in political climate and stuff longer term. It was true in the past, too. I mean, it's always been a problem in those industries. So it was true before he got involved. It's true after. But maybe he got involved in a period that was the best 30 years or so in that direction of favorable regulation.
Mm-hmm. Do you think they'll ever pay dividends during Buffett's lifetime? Or is that more so a plan afterwards? Yeah.
I think they might pay dividends during his lifetime. It depends. But it's pretty possible now. I wouldn't be surprised.
Like a 2% dividend yield, a typical dividend in the S&P 500? How do you think you would structure it? Would it be more so like a special dividend?
I think the issue is what he talked about, which is why Berkshire is safer as an insurance company and much, much safer even than I think they're rated and everything by comparison to some other insurance company things and some credit things, is that Berkshire, unlike a lot of highly rated companies, doesn't pay very high amounts of dividends, and it has stuff it could shut off if it needed to. Mm-hmm. And so like it's reinvesting huge amounts in the in Berkshire Hathaway Energy and stuff, and it could stop doing that. So it has a diverse amount of money coming in from things, but if it paid a regular dividend, it would be a weaker insurance company, I think, in the long run, and a weaker credit in the long run, because that's the biggest risk to that. It piles up so quickly that Berkshire could have severe losses. You know, they talked about like we want to have $50 billion around and stuff. Huge $50 billion of unexpected losses. It's not just that they have a cash pile that can absorb that. It's also that they would rebuild it very quickly because mm-hmm. they don't pay dividends. Whereas if you paid most of it in dividends, then it's very hard to rebuild that. That's the problem that lots of banks have, lots of insurance companies. And then they have disadvantageous equity issuance and stuff because of that. So it would be better for them to like turn it off and then turn it back on quickly, you know, being able to do that with special dividends and everything. But financial companies don't normally do that. And a big factor in their danger over time, I think, is the need to pay regular dividends. It certainly is for utilities.
Mm-hmm.
Like if something happens, the fact that they paid a lot of regular dividends and they want to resume doing it is a big part of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He wrote about, he said, at year-end, Berkshire owned 27.8% of Occidental Petroleum's common mm-hmm. shares and also owned warrants that for more than 5 years gives us the option to materially increase our ownership at a fixed price. Though we very much like our ownership as well as the option, Berkshire has no interest in purchasing or managing Occidental. So basically, owning the company outright, which he did say at last year's annual meeting. So he did say as of year-end, they own 27.8%. You could see from inside arbitrage, he has purchased more stock in 2024. So continuing to buy his stake in Occidental. It's interesting. Is this more so like a American Express and Coca-Cola position where he's going to want to hold it forever? I mean,
yes.
The way he's writing about it, it's very mm-hmm. much setting it up to be like that.
Yeah, and I think that's related to the realization that he's not going to be able to do other things. And so when Berkshire puts money out to use, they kind of have to put it out permanently. So yeah, how he starts it, he says, this year I'd like to describe two other investments we expect to maintain indefinitely. Like Coke and Amex, these commitments mm-hmm. are not huge relative to our resources. So then he talks about them. But the two he talks about is not just Occidental, which is a one-off, but then the basket of Japanese trading companies, both. Mm-hmm. And neither of these are great businesses. And they're not the kind of thing he would invest in normally. What they are is cheap enough and long enough durability assets, and they're doing the right thing in terms of capital allocation stuff more than other kinds of companies. But he's kind of resigned to doing that. And as he said, in those cases, they spent like 5 years, almost 4 or 5 years buying these things. So I think that that also is a real recognition that way of the reality. You're not going to buy and sell these things like he did at one time. Almost all of Berkshire's positions become like permanent positions because there's just too much cash to use. Whereas in the past, he might invest in something and then it goes up and then he can sell it if it's this kind of business, like an Occidental or the Japanese companies. But now these aren't even huge investments compared to what he already owns. So it's not like it was in the 70s or the 90s. He's not going to turn things over.
Yeah. So the five Japanese trading companies, a long-term mm-hmm. commitment, right? He did say that they own 9% and he has an agreement, or he told them that he would not go above 9.9% of those companies. And I mean, it's been a tremendous investment as well.
Yeah. So for Berkshire, it's the yen terms that really matter because, you know, in yen terms is what it really matters because they financed it with debt in Japan. If you had been an investor in the United States buying these things, obviously the yen has weakened a lot versus the dollar. In fact, the stocks might be a better investment for American investors now than in the past when Buffett bought them because the yen is so much weaker. And so if you left it unhedged and stuff and bought it then. So although Berkshire reports it in different ways, the economic way to think about it is that they basically finance it with yen and then get these returns, which means it's a very good investment, obviously, because they don't really have the losses from the yen weakening against the dollar.
You don't think he'll ever find another company in Japan, anything that's large enough that he could invest in?
I mean, it's not impossible that he could find a company, but I think Charlie died. Buffett is the age that he is, and the market started getting back into an overly expensive situation for him, combined with the huge cash hoard that he has. I think back when we were talking about COVID and stuff, the difference was that for a little while there, he was maybe hopeful that he would get to see another market environment in which he might have opportunities to allocate a lot of capital. Just because the markets decline, say 50%, say markets were down 50% this year, that wouldn't really drop the price of things that he'd be looking to buy the whole company by 50%. So that's the problem. Like, you get an opportunity to buy a lot of stocks if that happens, like a 2008 or something, but it doesn't necessarily mean that people will sell you the entire business. Microsoft was never saying it would sell all of itself to Berkshire at 10 times PE, even though the stock might have gotten down to that and he could have bought the stock. So if you're saying, like, could he buy Nintendo or Oriental Land and Development or whatever. Yeah, I mean, it's possible. He probably understands those things well enough and could do it, but they'd have to want, it would have to be a Japanese company that would want to sell its entire self to an American company at a negotiated price. I don't see how that would ever be an attractive price and stuff. So it's very hard for me to believe.
Isn't it interesting? We've talked a lot about investing in Japan because your history with Japanese net nets, right? However, I really do feel like Buffett invested in Japan sort of at the bottom, right? The past couple mm-hmm. of years, it's become much more popular to invest in Japan and people talking about the bargains and the Japanese, you know, company handbook. It really seems like he was sort of at the beginning of that, and now it's becoming a lot more popular again. They've changed how they want to market themselves to investors, how they think about their own capital that they have in their business, the stock exchanges, you know, promoting buybacks and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It really seems like he was at the beginning of this new cycle in the Japanese markets.
Yeah, and Japanese stocks, I mean, there's different indexes, but basically taking last year and this year together, they've outperformed U.S. stocks. American corporate governance in general has gotten worse, you know, corporate governance, capital allocation stuff, from the perspective of what Buffett looks for. And Japanese has gotten a lot better. I mean, I think he says that flat out, that for a large company, these companies is better, that their capital allocation stuff, that the way that they run the business is better than the average S&P 500 American company. And that's true. And some of that is the American ones getting worse and the Japanese ones getting better. But yeah, he says in certain important ways, all five companies follow shareholder-friendly policies that are much superior to those customarily practiced in the U.S. They've all reduced the number of shares outstanding at attractive prices. They've been far less aggressive in their own compensation, and they have dividend payout ratios of like 30%. So there's not a ton of American companies that do that. Some do. But even if you say, okay, say that Microsoft did something like that or something. Yeah, but it wasn't at attractive prices. Right? If they bought back some of their stock or someone else, you know. So that, I think, is a very big part of it.
What'd you think about the improving rates in the insurance business? He had said that he had thought it would be a great year. Yep. It ultimately was. He was able to foresee that. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, big improvement in insurance and stuff. And I think that's what mixed up people in the business press talking about their earnings. Berkshire's earnings were pretty bad, but the insurance was good. But you could have predicted insurance ahead of time, so it's not a surprise. So that's why Buffett sounds so down on it and stuff, on their results. I think it's because things he tried to predict and was wrong about that were more could change turned out badly for Berkshire. Whereas insurance, you often know a year ahead because, you know, if you go back to reading his letters from the 70s, he talks about that. You can just look at what inflation is and what they're raising the rates by. You can tell that those rates are going to be in effect for at least the next 6 months or something, and people are going to be coming off 6 month rates the whole time, even the shortest tail stuff. So you basically know for like a year out or 9 months waited or something, like what it's going to look like right away without even needing to predict what it'll be a few months down the road in terms of the price changes. So you kind of know ahead of time, like an insurance company knows this year what it should be earning next year and stuff in terms of pricing, which is the most important thing usually. Now, in terms of like losses and cat things and stuff that could happen to them, sure, they don't know. There could always be one-off events that they have no idea about, but the pricing thing is more certain and important, and those rates are up a lot. I think people can see that if you have auto insurance, if you have homeowners insurance, probably you've seen it recently. You know, you've seen increases that are probably some of the biggest you've seen in your life, unless you were doing in the 70s and 80s. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is because of inflation and the ability to take price.
Market's better now. I mean, so there was inflation, so they needed to do it, but it's that the insurers are able to increase their prices. So, I mean, it's sort of like, I think there was an airline thing where they said one of the airlines added a baggage fee, right? And then following on that, another airline added the baggage fee. That's very important because it's a signal to each of them that the first one does it, and then it depends on if everyone follows them or not. And then they can all raise their baggage fees once they do that. So someone has to go out there first and bell the cat is the expression, right? So they have to go out there first and take this risk, and then everyone else will get the same benefit from it because then they can all raise it afterwards. So it's a better market, you know, and it's the same as if stock prices came down to us and we were more excited about the prospects in the future. Insurance has that kind of cycle. So they needed to do it because of inflation stuff that we talked about before, but they're able to do it now, in part maybe because they weren't scared as much things in COVID and stuff like we talked about. But there's also other things maybe. Berkshire's big in reinsurance, and I think reinsurance, we talked about that with Florida and their insurance stuff. Reinsurance market had been getting better for a few years, whereas when I looked back through it and stuff and was saying, why did the Florida insurers do so well for so long? The primary ones did because it looked like, from my best estimates, the reinsurance, like trying to index it to see what compare prices, was weakening like every year for a decade or something, basically. It was never really going up much, and then it started to go up. So, and Berkshire's big in reinsurance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let's speculate. What happens to Berkshire's stock if they decide to start paying a dividend?
That's a really good question. I think they'd like to buy back their stock if they could, but I don't think they want to buy back their stock if it's overpriced.
Do you think he thinks it's overpriced?
I doubt he thinks it's as cheap as some people think he thinks it is, because the complication is the price to book thing is a very general rule. And something like Apple trades much closer to the appropriate price. Like, more and more of Berkshire is probably not, because of the way that it works in terms of how they market, they mark to market the whole portfolio. They're marking to market the whole portfolio. The portfolio is big and it might be overvalued, as all stock portfolios might be. You take that into account with his pessimism about certainly energy, and, you know, the railroad sounds more like he thinks it's a short-term thing that they could improve. I would think that he doesn't think that the multiple on Berkshire should be higher than it was in the past, in terms of where they would buy. And we know where they would buy. And so they've bought, but they haven't bought it at a highly accelerated rate when it's been at those sorts of levels. So absent some big decline in the stock market or something, I don't think you'll see a chance to buy back a lot of stock that way, which would mean dividends are a possibility. I don't know if they would do dividends as a year-end thing and determine it each year based on saying how much excess capital they have and stuff like that. I'd be surprised if they paid a large regular dividend. They might do small, but that's really out of line with how Berkshire thinks. Mm-hmm. I almost think that they would think,
I agree.
Yeah,
that they differently. Yeah.
Right. They would think, and when they introduce it, it would be bigger rather than introducing sort of a token thing. Even when they do small buybacks, it's not to indicate they're doing small things. It's just that's what was out there. The stock went up or whatever. You know, I don't think that they think that way. So they would look to do a bigger amount, and people can kind of calculate how much their cash build is each year and stuff. If he's saying that they have a significant amount of excess cash, then it wouldn't be crazy to think that dividends could be of the kind of size of a cash build, especially because if you ever use the excess cash for something and there's just inflation and everything, like, earnings go up over time. So it actually becomes easier to maintain that level with the dividend. I think there'd be a lot of thinking about how it affects the insurance business and stuff, though. Because I think that's the big benefit to Berkshire, is their financial strength that they have throughout these things. And that's the part that people undervalue. That if you split up into all the different parts, you know, it wouldn't be as easy for them to, like, increase how much business they were writing insurance by a lot, and still feel that they were the strongest insurance company in the world and everything, if you broke it up into its different pieces, you know? And then you'd have other things that have to pay out basically everything in earnings as dividends if they were broken off, because you wouldn't want to run them differently. You know, the miscellaneous category, basically, would be paying out nearly 100% of dividends probably or something if it was split off to be its own company. So I'd, you know, on day one, if you split up into five pieces or something, it might be worth more. But I think in the long run, it's not as good from financial perspective and stuff.
Mm-hmm. My prediction is whatever he does, it probably will be unusual, and it will set the standard for new companies on how to think about doing it. You know?
Yeah. I do also think that there's probably be some thought about if it will be related to a transition or something, just because I'm not sure that this is something that would be done at Buffett's age and with already planned successors kind of named of what it will be, without kind of pulling people in and thinking about that and what they want to do and everything. I mean, he did say that these are basically like permanent positions, and so that's kind of saying to the next people, you better not sell this, you know. But I don't know that he would just unilaterally do something at his age and with them deciding how they take over and everything. So I think there might be some discussion about something as big as like the dividend policy and what they want to do and stuff. It could actually involve, for the first time, someone other than Buffett talking about the overall capital allocation, because it needs to be something that they're comfortable with taking over. You know, they can't pick something that then they want to reverse the next year, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Any other thoughts on this year's letter? Obviously, he went into the annual meeting in 2023, coming to Omaha, his thoughts on Omaha, the apparently Omaha breeds exceptional humans, mm-hmm. which, you know, it's probably true. Any other final thoughts on it?
Yeah, I think when he doesn't criticize people directly, you have to understand by naming them. And he also doesn't criticize sometimes by not talking about what's wrong there. I think that there was definitely criticism of pilot, the pilot deal in there. I think there was criticism of the current situation at Burlington Northern, but saying that this is not a permanent problem so much, that this could be something that's turned around, but we're the worst among our peers. And he pretty much lays that out pretty clearly. And I obviously he's not happy about what's happening with the regulation and stuff in the utility business. And so that's the one that could be the biggest pivot is in the utility business. But he does kind of go out of his way to talk about the different risks in both of those things, which remind me of like 1970s types of risks of additional regulation and inflation stuff and contract things and all that. So that's a worrying kind of shift in his opinion about those businesses. And they're very big for Berkshire.
Got it. Cool. Well, I want to thank everybody so much for tuning in with the both of us on the Focus Compounding Podcast. If this is the first time you're joining us, be sure to check out all of our content that we push out into the investing universe. If you're interested in learning about our money management services, you can reach out to me at Andrew@FocusCompounding.com. or go to FocusCompounding.com and click that Invest With Us tab to get more information on that. Thank you guys so much for all the support. Be sure to hit the subscribe button wherever you're listening or watching us. And we will see you in the next podcast. Take care.